It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and today is the last day of Black History Month. Its origins go back to the summer of 1915, when University of Chicago alumnus Carter G. Woodson put together an exhibit highlighting the progress that had been made in the 50 years since Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation. For the rest of today's show, we are going to talk about two more pieces of Black history, specifically those on display for the first time at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield. Here to talk about this is the Museum and Library's Executive Director, Christina Schutt. She served in that role since 2021. Before that, she was based in Little Rock, Arkansas, where she served as Executive Director of the Mosaic Templars Cultural Center, which focuses on African American history. She holds two master's degrees, one in history, the other in library science and archives management. Director Schutt, welcome back to the 21st Show.
Thanks for having me today. It's great to be with you.
So let's start with, I mentioned these two new pieces at the museum. Well, not new, but why don't we start with the badge? This is a badge. It's from Charleston, South Carolina, circa 1810s. We as a radio show do not have the benefit of visuals. So can you describe for what somebody visiting the museum would see?
Yeah. So if you came to Springfield to see the tag, what you would see is a small badge. It's a sort of diamond-shaped badge. It has the word Charleston imprinted on the text. It would be about the size of a little bit bigger, but kind of between a quarter and maybe the palm of your hand, somewhere in between there. It's stamped with the number 181, which would have meant that that was the 181st badge issued that year. It has, of course, the name Mechanic on it. Mechanic referring to someone who was a laborer, right? A carpenter, a skilled worker. And then the name or the number 1819, referring to the year that it was issued. And then, of course, in the back of the badge, it has the word Lafar, referring to Lafar, who was the person who issued the badges, created them.
And this thing is not like a shiny police badge. I mean, if you saw this hunk of metal sitting on the ground, someone could very easily overlook it or think of it as trash. But what was the purpose of a badge like this?
So these badges were primarily issued to enslaved laborers who were being leased out in Charleston, South Carolina. So in 1819, we know that there were somewhere about 2,240 or so of these badges issued to people. So as an enslaver, what you would have done if you didn't need, for example, your carpenter to do any work for you, you would have leased that person out and you would have had him do work maybe for the city, building bridges or repairing boat work or doing some other type of labor. And then whatever wages that he earned, those wages would have been given to you as his enslaver. And so that was one way in which Charleston as a city and as enslavers benefited from work that sometimes they didn't need.
How common was this sort of identification requirement?
Well, many cities across the United States, there was sort of a history of having kind of identification or having some piece, right, of paper to identify people's enslaved movement. Charleston, South Carolina is actually very unique in the sense that it's the only city that we know of to date that issued these metal badges and did so year after year, beginning in about 1783 when they passed a city ordinance that required them. They also, for a brief couple of years, mandated that any free Black people living in Charleston, South Carolina, have a badge as well. And so badges were issued in that case, but they were primarily used for tracking the movements of enslaved laborers.
Why the free? What do we know about the rationale for making freedmen and women wear this?
Well, the rationale was using this as another way in which to really to license and to dictate the movement of Black people. You know, you think about if you were a person who had to have a badge to leave your home, to do any work in the city, that you had to pay a tax for that. You had to be licensed the same way that we would license a vehicle today. If you had to do these sorts of things, right, and these extra requirements that were placed on you, it was meant as a form of intimidation. intimidation. It was meant as a form of helping to control the Black population in the city, because of course African Americans overwhelmingly outnumbered whites in the town, and so this was one way in which kind of keeping tabs on people.
Yeah, says a lot about the way we treated Black men and women in America before the Civil War. Somebody made the point, I was talking this morning, it's almost like the way we think of car registrations today.
Absolutely. And I think it's so important that we document, that we talk about this history, that we share this kind of documentation, because it speaks to that, the broader importance of African-American history. It helps give contextualization for the long struggle for civil rights. I mean, one of the kind of flip sides of, you know, an object of oppression like this is that it also signifies the kind of the skilled labor that was present within the Black community. You know, oftentimes I've heard, right, people talking about enslaved people as if they didn't have skills, the docile, right? This was one of the lies that the Confederacy and oppressors and segregationists used for years. And these badges really speak and stand in stark contrast to that, that these people, these men, and in some cases women, you know, were highly skilled. Right. They were skilled enough that they were worthy to be sent out. Right. And their labor leased out.
You know, I'm always fascinated by how objects like this, common objects that most people wouldn't think was, you know, worthy of keeping around after that year had expired and they got the badge stamped 1820. What do we understand about how this survived from, you know, someone walking around Charleston, South Carolina, to being on display in 2025 in Springfield, Illinois?
Yeah, it is sort of remarkable. I mean, I think one of the reasons that these badges survive is because they are made of metal. Unlike paper, that tends to be even more kind of less tangible, it's harder to preserve, right? These metal tags would have, as the city of Charleston fell during the Civil War, likely would have been tossed into the dirt, right? Buried under rubble. And that's one of the reasons why they do get preserved, right? It's because they're sort of lost as these kind of tiny elements lost in time. You know, for us, I think the preservation and keeping these badges and putting it on display as we've done is really, again, this kind of this testament to this deeply painful history that we share as a country. But it's also an opportunity to reflect on and think about not only how far we've come, but where we want to be. What are the lessons and things that we can learn from this time period about places we don't want to be as a country and things we don't want to have happen again? And how can we use this tag, which was meant to strip humanity from people, right? We don't learn the person's name who owned this badge. It's just a simple number, 181. And yet, how can we value an individual's humanity and people's humanity in today?
All right, let me reintroduce our conversation. If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st show. We're talking for the last part of our program today about two pieces of Black history from the 19th century that recently went on display for the first time at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield. We're talking about the history behind those pieces with the Museum and Library's Executive Director, Christina Schutt. So in the rest of our time together, let's turn to this poster. You mentioned paper doesn't survive as well. This piece did. It's new to the museum. This was a sort of a painting or a poster used to recruit Black men for the U.S. Army after Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. Describe the art for us.
Yeah, so this poster features a Union soldier, United States soldier, holding a flag, an American flag that says freedom to the slave, right? Proclaiming freedom. One of my favorite things about this poster is that it also features these beautifully iconic images, like a schoolhouse where Black people are learning how to read. You actually see a Black man in the foreground reading a newspaper, talking about freedom and the Emancipation Proclamation. We have Black soldiers who are valiantly fighting to defend the United States against the armed insurgency. And then my favorite piece across this is that not only do you have these Black soldiers who are extending their arms to enslaved people, but you have enslaved Black people themselves breaking their chains and rising up. So whereas in many posters or many iconography of the time, it's often, you know, a white person who's leaning down to help an enslaved African African up. In this case, the black men themselves are breaking their chains and lifting themselves up. On the reverse of the poster, it proclaims the proclamation, right? All slaves were made freemen by Abraham Lincoln, President of the United States. Come then, able-bodied colored men, to the nearest United States camp and fight for the Stars and Stripes. And it's just such a rousing and joyous poster, right? Meant to encourage black men to come and fight for the United States.
And yet there was ambivalence about that, right? William Sherman famously did not want any African-Americans in Uncle Billy's army. He put it a lot more crudely than that. And they couldn't be officers, for example. I'm not sure if the officer depicted here is meant to be African-American or not. But talk about the challenge that these men faced.
Absolutely. They face an unequal service from the beginning. You know, I think one of the things that actually Lincoln is sort of charged with, that he's getting all of these, like Sherman, like other of these white officers who are writing to him and saying, well, should we just have the black people serving in menial tasks? Should we just allow them to cook our food? Should we just, they're asking him these questions because they don't want to put them in combat roles. There was real fear among the white population that black men would run scared at the first sight of bullets, of enemy fire, or that they would take up arms and attack all white people. And in fact, that's not what happened. They actually fight valiantly. They fight brilliantly against the Confederates. And so Lincoln's getting all these letters, and he actually brilliantly writes back and says, you know, you say you are not willing to fight for the Negro, but the Negro is willing to fight and die for you. And I love that sort of sentiment that Lincoln actually sees the valiance with which they're fighting, and he acknowledges it. In one case, actually, black men aren't given equal pay. They're actually paid less than their white counterparts, and they refuse that pay until the end of the Civil War, where they finally not only get that pay, the equal pay that they deserve, but they get it back in full, the back pay wages as well. So, you know, from the outset, black men and black people realize not only what the true cause of the Civil War was, but also what the opportunity is if the United States wins, that it means freedom forever for them and their families.
Someday I have on my long list of stories to do something about the 29th USCT organized in Quincy, Illinois. We'll have to have that be for another day, though. Just a couple of minutes left in our time together, Director Schutt. What do you hope ultimately people take away from these pieces of Black history, American history?
Well, I hope people see that it's just that, that it is American history, that is worthy to be talked about, that is worthy to be told, that there is no fear in telling the truth in history. You know, I hear a lot of times where people are maybe fearful or don't think that we should talk about, these pockets of history, these important pieces of history. But I think pieces like this, these artifacts, really speak to our historical past. They speak to where the United States has been, and also give us hope and possibility for where we can be in the future. You know, one of the things about the United States during the Civil War, the Union, right, is that it's a country that is willing to fight together to preserve and build something different. And they didn't know what it would be. Abraham Lincoln didn't know. He didn't start the Civil War thinking that he was going to immediately end slavery by the end of it. But that was sort of the possibility, and that was what abolitionists and what enslaved people really pushed for and had happened. And so by telling these fuller and more complete stories of American history, I hope that that we as a country can be better grounded in our history to know not only where we've come from, but where we can go into the future.
Christina Schutt, Executive Director at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me today.
And that is all the time for our program today. Coming up on Monday's show, it's been years since avian flu started causing trouble for farmers. It's affecting animals and the food we buy at the supermarket. The risk to people remains low, but cuts to science and public health under the Trump administration are putting in jeopardy our preparedness for disease outbreaks. We'll talk about that again on Monday's 21st show. Before we go, I also want to acknowledge that former Illinois Governor Jim Edgar this week announced he's undergoing treatment for pancreatic cancer. In a statement, he said, "We do not underestimate this challenge, but we have confidence in the medical team helping us address it." Governor Edgar has been a guest on our show many times over the years, and we extend our sincere best wishes to the governor and his family. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Colson Khan. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again on Monday.